Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Nicole, for inviting me here this evening. How many islands do you think exist in the entire Great Lake Basin? Just a guess. No, but there has to be at least 1862, so you're good on that account. 3,000. Take 3,000, multiply it by 10, and add a little bit more. So in the Great Lake Basin, there are approximately 35,000 islands, and this is the point at which sometimes people say, but what exactly is the definition of an island? Which is a very good question to ask. An island defined in the Great Lake Basin has to be above the level of the lake the entire year. And it has to have, depending on where you are, one or two trees on it. So when you get in the Georgian Bay, and there's more to the Georgian Bay problems in terms of figuring out islands, because if this was blown up large, this whole shore along here is a series of peninsulas and islands. And it's hard to tell sometimes if you're looking at a peninsula or island. And in fact, on that particular length of the Great Lake Basin, this part that's all along here, many people who have cottages on the mainland actually have to use a boat to get to their cottage because what is behind them is bush and not developed road. So when you look at the Great Lake Basin, the majority of the islands are in Lake Huron, and part of that has to do with this Niagara escarpment that I mentioned, which comes from Lake Michigan here and goes all the way across like this. Can you see the arc there? And it leaves a lot of islands in its wake. So the majority of the islands of these 35,000 can be found in Lake Huron and even more specifically the Georgian Bay. So how many Great Lake Islands have you been to? And I want to ask you in particular. Probably quite a few if
no,
you were...
No, really. I think I really haven't. Pablo Island?
Yeah, it counts. It counts.
So, Island.
Yeah, okay.
And
South Bass?
South Bass.
Okay, so that's... I bet there's more you've been to, and you'll... Anybody been to five? Thinks they've been to at least five? Oh, yeah. Yes, Bronwyn actually went to some islands with me. So I have an interesting part of my book to share with you, which is how I figured out how many islands I'd been to before I took on this project. So I'm going to be reading right from the beginning of the preface, and you're going to need a visual, I suppose. Okay, this is my husband, Craig Daly. A couple of people in the audience actually know him, and you'll learn why this is a visual for how I actually decided to do this a project in the first place. The book I'm holding in my hands was conceived during an impromptu happy hour on one of the best known of the Great Lake Basin Islands, Mackinac. After a day exploring the island on rented bikes, my husband and I were relaxing on the porch of the Harbor View Inn Bed and Breakfast, enjoying goat cheese on crackers with a good Sauvignon Blanc we'd purchased up the street at Dowd's Market. Have you all been to Mackinac? Have you been to Dowd's Market? Dowd's Market is a pretty incredible market. It is the oldest family-owned grocery store in the United States. Having shown up for reasons other than Michigan's Republican Convention on the island, so every fall, the state Republican Convention is held on Mackinac. We were there for other reasons, but it was well underway, and we were indulging as a result in some serious people watching. As visitors to the island, many of them convention goers, streamed by on Main Street. I was trying unsuccessfully to imagine such a scene taking place on our island, Canada's Pelee Island, a rural island where at that point we'd owned a cottage for about 15 years. How could two islands in the same bodies of water, in the same freshwater body system of water, how could they be so different? And those are at the extremes, just about. We poured another glass of wine and reminisced about the other islands in the Great Lake Basin we'd visited over the years. Belle Isle, Bablo, and Gros Isle in the Detroit River. So I bet some of you have been to those, Bablo being the amusement park that is an Ontario island. Beaver Island in Lake Michigan, Manitoulin Island and Flower Pot Island in Lake Huron, South Bass Island and Kelly's Island in addition to Pelee Island in Lake Erie. So we'd been to 10. That night, looking out our third floor window, beyond the lights at the pier on Haldimand Bay to the Straits of Mackinac, I was remembering what very wonderful and very different adventures we'd had on the 10 Great Lake Islands we'd visited. Could there be more islands to explore, ones that we'd missed? Surely there must be a book that would give me more Great Lakes island hopping ideas. So when I got back to the mainland, I looked, but I could find no such book. So instead, I found myself ordering a 1953, as old as me, National Geographic map of the Great Lakes region and spreading out on my dining room table. I started fantasizing about freshwater island hopping. But when I looked more closely, I discovered, much to my astonishment, that the Great Lake Basin actually has approximately 35,000 islands. Clearly, I was going to need some criteria to frame my adventure destinations. First, I decided, the island had to be in the Great Lake Basin, in a lake or a river or strait connecting two of the lakes. So I was staying, I'm not there right now, but I was staying with the major lakes, the major rivers, because there's other lakes and rivers in the Great Lake Basin, but I was going with the major, those 11 bodies of water. Then, given that I wasn't keen on traveling either by small boat or plane, I decided the island had to be accessible by ferry or bridge. In my mind, I began stringing islands in the Great Lakes and their rivers together like rosary beads on a cord of water. Somewhere along the way, my fantasy became a plan, and ultimately, I discovered 136 islands in the Great Lake Basin that met my qualifications. So I'd like to take you to some of these islands tonight, and I'd like to begin. I'm going to take you to an island in each of the Great Lakes, and we're going to start upstream in Lake Superior, which is the largest of the lakes, and we're going to go to Isle Royale. How many people have been to Isle Royale? Oh, yay. Okay, that's nice. One of my favorite islands, Isle Royale. And this is another important part of my trip. Doing a pilot for this in 2011, I took a week off work and I went to 10 islands that were within a day's drive of me, and Beaver Island, because I had a friend there. And I tried to figure out, what would I write in the book? If I was writing a book about Great Lake Basin Islands, what would it have in it? I am a fiction writer by trade, and I teach fiction writing. All I've ever done is write, but I'm not a nonfiction, or was not a nonfiction writer before this book. So I wasn't quite sure how to go about such a big project that involves so much information. During the pilot, I discovered I accidentally took a friend with me on one of them. And people were much more willing to answer my questions and talk to me if I had a friend with me. I guess they were not afraid I was going to glom onto them and want to join them on whatever trip they were on. But also, it gave me an opportunity to see the island through another pair of eyes. And we could talk about it afterwards. In fact, I probably would have left Drummond Island at least 24 hours earlier if I had not had a traveling companion with me that suggested maybe I wanted to give it a second chance. This is Vicki Brennan. She and I served on the school board years ago in Ferndale. This is an August morning. We're on our way to Isle Royale, and we decided to do something a little bit different. Most Michiganders would come up to the Keweenaw Peninsula and go over, say, from Houghton to Isle Royale. But I decided Minnesota only has one island they can get to by bridge or ferry in the basin. Shouldn't we include the Minnesotans in this adventure? So we drove around and left from Grand Portage here and went over to Isle Royale. You may ask, why does Isle Royale not belong to Minnesota? I would reply, why does it not belong to Canada? It's much closer to them. It's a very interesting story. If you want to read a little bit of interesting history that has to do with some Phantom Island and eager explorers, look up and find out why Isle Royale belongs to us. It's too long a story to get into tonight. I mention it in my book. So we're going on a passenger ferry. Now, the one advantage or disadvantage of leaving from Grand Portage is that you go along the entire north coast of Isle Royale, and it means that you are taking a 7.5-hour ferry boat ride. In August, if the lake is like glass, as it was this morning that we left, that's great. But Lake Superior is quite the lady, and you don't always get that. So I'm just grateful that we had the perfect conditions for that 7.5-hour ride. So I have to tell you, while you admire the tiny wildlife there, that the only island I was had any apprehension about going to was Isle Royale. And I think part of it was the ferry ride, because even a ferry ride from Houghton is still a long ferry ride in Lake Superior water. I don't like bears. Just bear with me a moment. I don't like bears at all, even though I'm an avid camper and have had some run-ins with bears, which is probably why I don't like them. I was very happy in researching the island to discover there are no bears on Isle Royale. I liked it more already. There are wolf and there are moose, and they are the subjects of a study that's been going on since the early 50s by Rolf Peterson on predator animals. The year that I went, which was 2013, there were only 8 or 9 wolves left and 1,800 moose. The island cannot support 1,800 moose, but the wolves can't get there because of the fact that the ice bridge doesn't form anymore like it used to. So that's why you may have heard on the radio, the big discussion about, are we going to import, are we going to take some wolves over there to balance this? As of February of this past year, there were 2 wolves left, a father and a daughter. And again, the moose population had gotten even larger. So this is a real serious thing. The island really can't support that many moose. But so here we are coming into the easternmost bay. This is Washington Harbor. It's a very deep cut harbor. You go on it for a long time. People had gotten bored, had gone inside. And I'm out alone on the back of the boat. And all of a sudden, I found myself yelling, moose! And there was a mother and her two twin calves. But I was a little puzzled. They actually were out pretty far in the water. They were sort of like up to their chests. And when the boat came and made the sound and disturbed them, the mother rounded up the calves. And now they're sort of marching close to shore. And, you know, moose, they are really funny to watch when they're up to their knees in water because they pull their legs all the way out. When we got to Windigo, which was where we were dropping some people off and picking other people up before we went to Rock Harbor, which is where we were staying, I asked the park ranger, you know, is that where you see moose usually? She said, no. She said, we have had unseasonably record temperatures for Isle Royale this week. They don't perspire, can't perspire, so they are in the water to cool off. I want you to remember that unseasonable extreme heat statement there that will come in handy in understanding something else I show you. The real advantage, so when we left Windigo, now we come back out the harbor, we're going 45 miles along the north shore of Isle Royale. That's how long it is. And the whole 45 miles, this is basically what you see, this thrust up volcanic bedrock topped by boreal forests. Very, very tall birch trees, beautiful. And after an hour or so of this, you start feeling like you have maybe understand a little bit differently about wilderness. Like I said, I love to camp. I've been in a lot of national forests. I've never had just that boat ride along that whole shore to see that much wilderness was in itself worth the ride. Now, if that lake had not been as smooth as it was, I might have a different recollection about that ride. So Isle Royale is wild. There is a lot of wilderness, but you don't have to be a hiker, camper, backpacker, or anything else to enjoy it. This is Rock Harbor Lodge. Several buildings here. We were staying in the first floor that was cantilevered out over the rocks. We heard the waves all night coming in from our open balcony door. There is also a fine restaurant. There's a bar and grill, hot water, nice, easy walks right around the Rock Harbor area. So what many people do is they start at Windigo and they hike the 40-mile Greenstone Ridge Trail that goes along the spine of the island to get here to Rock Harbor, have a hot shower and a beer. And they end their hike here. So they backpack and they end here. But I want to say just how accessible this is. So while Vicki and I were here for a couple days, we met 2 groups of travelers that really showed what exactly the National Park Service was capable of doing. We met a couple in their early 90s. They were traveling by themselves. This had been on their list of places they wanted to go, and they were there for a week. And they would stay. They stayed in the lodge. They had fine meals in the evening. But the rest of the time, they did day trips and canoed. They're very doable. If they can do it, there's nobody here that can top them in age. I guarantee that. The other group, we met a family of five, and they had a 15-year-old son who had a pretty severe disability and was in a wheelchair. And they were having a great time. They're totally accessible. So before you cross Isle Royal, off of your list of places that you want to visit if you haven't been there, this is really quite doable, and you don't have to take a 7.5-hour ferry ride. You can go from much closer. So the one day that Vicki and I decided I wanted to see the Greenstone Ridge, I wanted to go up. This is Mount Franklin. From the height, you can see Lake Superior, along with some of the 400 other islands that make up Isle Royal National Park. So Isle Royal is just one piece of it. There's 400 other islands around it, which is why people go there and often kayak. And you can't see in this picture because the quality isn't good enough, but we could see Canada. So when we're standing up there, it was Canada. Now, remember, and here we are, it was a 10-hour round trip. It was a 10-hour hike round trip. Remember I said about the extremely hot weather? Well, the day that we hiked was the hottest day. It was 88 and 89 degrees when we were hiking pretty much straight uphill. We had brought each two big bottles of water, but it wasn't enough. And when we're standing up here grinning, I remember thinking, and now what do we do? We have no water, and we have to go down, right? Fortunately, we were saved. The person who took this picture says, well, you have been eating the thimbleberries, right? I hadn't even heard of thimbleberries. If any of you go to the UP, there are thimbleberries up there. So these little berries look sort of like raspberries, but they're not as deep, but they're wider. So when you pick them, you actually could put them on your index finger like a sewing thimble, which is why the name. We must have eaten thousands of these on the way down. They're very juicy. They're very good. They probably were responsible for us being in better shape than we were after this particular hike. Another reason to go to Isle Royal is it's got 24 pristine lakes, interior lakes. So when you hear about people going to canoe, they're not necessarily canoeing to those barrier islands unless the lake is very calm, but they are canoeing on these lakes. What I found most interesting about these lakes, and we did canoe on a couple of them, if you're an avid canoer, the portages between these lakes are pretty easy. There's a Michigander, Jim Defresnay, who's written a book about just canoeing and being able to do all these trips connecting the interior lakes. But what I really loved was this is where the loons come. So the loons migrate here in May, and they court and mate and build their nests, and they have their fledge their birds, and they get their babies stronger. They have to leave the island in September. It's a really small window, and there's a lot of loons. On the lake, we saw many more loons than we probably saw people the entire time that we were there, which is pretty special. On Pelee Island, we hear loons. I've only seen a loon maybe twice in 25 years on that island, but here, where they come to raise their families, you see quite a few, and here even more. By the time that I left Rock Harbor, and remember, it was very hot, the lake's cool, hence the fog. In fact, once we got out of this harbor, you couldn't see the front of our boat, and so we were accompanied by the horn of the boat blowing for many hours till we got in water where you could see. But by the time I was on the boat leaving Rock Harbor, I couldn't wait to get back to Isle Royal. It really grew on me. So from being the most apprehensive to one of my favorite out of the 136 islands I visited, put it on your bucket list. Next, we're going to go. So Lake Superior has two other islands you can get to by ferry or bridge. One is Grand Island, which is right about here, and you go off above Munising. And the other is Madeline Island, which is here. You go off of Bayfield in Wisconsin. And this is the Apostle Islands National Park. Madeline is not part of the national park, but it is part of the Apostle Islands. And it's settled, and there's a lot to do on it. So those are two other islands in Lake Superior, which has the fewest islands. Lake Superior drains through the St. Mary's River down into Lake Huron. And like I said, Lake Huron and Lake Michigan by hydrologists are considered one and the same lake. Generally, the water flow is from west to east, like much of the rest of the basin. But about every 3 to 5 days, it reverses itself, and the water flows east to west in the straits. So you can see that would not happen unless the elevation, I think at the most there's 3 feet different between these two lakes at any part. We're going to go to Lake Michigan first, and we're going to go to Washington Island and Rock Island. Has anybody been to either of these two islands? How about Door County? Anybody been to Door County? Okay, so next time you go to Door County, you want to keep going. Door County is this finger, this part of the Niagara Escarpment that separates Lake Michigan from Green Bay, okay? At the end of this island, at the end of this peninsula, is the Washington Island, and you can take another ferry from Washington Island to Rock Island, which is off its northeast corner. I discovered in driving, I went with Karen Klein, an artist friend from Pleasant Ridge, and she pointed out, we were coming up here, and all of a sudden there was water on both sides of the car, and we realized the Sturgeon Bay comes in very deep here. And back when they were doing all the canals, like in the 1800s, they cut through a shipping channel so that people could take boats, could go right through here where it's much safer than up here, where you may have heard the term death's door. That's because so many shipwrecks happen there. The current is pretty scary. It's only a 25-minute ferry from the tip of the Door County Peninsula to Washington Island. And again, I was doing this all in the summer between May and September, including May and September. So we were blessed again with great, smooth, calm water. But we did realize there's actually another island here, which is what I call the mainland island, because it's cut off by water. It's got water all on four sides of it now, that last 7 miles across there being man-made. So if you look at Washington Island, what you notice is it looks very rural. Well, it is. You can see all the farms across here and then some trees around the edges, woods. You may remember Wisconsin when you had to learn the natural resources of states. You might have done that in fifth grade, like I did. Wisconsin produces a lot of cheese. A lot of cows are on the mainland, but there's a very large number of cows grazing on Washington Island that was used in terms of cheese making. They have a historic dairy, and they still have a lot of cows. The other thing that Washington Island, and you may, if you grew up in the 50s, when I visited their farm museum, there was a potato sack, and it, you know how you see something you haven't seen for decades? And it was like, my mother used to buy those potatoes. Well, Washington Island potatoes were sold in Detroit. So you yourself may have eaten a Washington Island potato at one time or another. In the book, for every of the main island chapters, of which there are 38, I looked at what natural sites can you see, what history's been preserved, what cultural attractions are there currently by residents that live there now, where can you get more information about the island, and how can you support the island? The islands need some support. This is an important part of the Great Lakes here. So with Washington Island, I laid my slides out this way. So I'm going to show you first. This was my favorite natural site that there was there on the island. This is called Jackson Harbor Ridges, and it's there to protect a unique dune ecology. This is Jackson Harbor that you're looking at. It will show up again when we go to Rock Island because this is where the boat goes from. So this is what this looks like. They're very mild dunes. This isn't Sleeping Bear dunes. But it goes on for a long way. There's trails through it, and the trail goes all the way around the harbor, and there's a lot of very subtle beauty. So we've got the Indian paintbrush was in bloom. This was the second week of June, to give you an idea of when I was doing this. This was a stone crop, a kind of sedum, and then the eastern red columbine. So when I was talking to the innkeeper when we got back from this hike, She said, oh, it's just like your garden. Something different blooms, you know, pretty much in a cycle all year round. And there was a lot of these flowers. She said, you come back in a week, 10 days from now, and it will be a whole nother show. And I was with a photographer and, this artist who was taking a lot of photographs to paint when she got back. So she was very instrumental in seeing some of the more subtle beauty here. There was also some rather majestic beauty. Oh, there we go. There were two pairs of American bald eagles at the end of the trail off the harbor. This one gave me the evil eye for quite a while until I left, so I'm assuming there must have been a nest nearby. There's also a lot of man-made beauty there. This is not historical. This is a replica of a church, a type of church that was built in Borgland, Norway, only between the 11th and 13th century. It's called a stavkirk. They call it the stavkirk because obviously it's the only one, probably the only one in the States. But the reason it's called a stavkirk is you'll notice that all of the boards are running vertically instead of horizontally. That's true like staves. So that's where that name came from. Kirk meaning church, and the stav part of it is the stave. And that's true all on the interior as well. All of the carpentry is done with the boards running vertically. This was built by a church on the island. They got all of the island involved in doing it. This was in 1990, it was completed. And you might ask, well, what do they do with it? The thing that it's probably most beloved for is for chamber music concerts. The acoustics in this are incredible. So this is open all the way up when you're inside. So they also do memorial services and they do small weddings. So it's a very pretty, I think they probably do a lot of wedding photography around it, even if the wedding is not inside. On the island, there are four museums, which is a lot for a Great Lake Basin island. This is an interesting museum that was started, and it was his life work by a man named Jan Jacobsen, if I want to say it Danish, from Denmark in the 1930s. He bought a piece of land on a lake that was where the Potawatomi had a fishing village. And he set out to find all the artifacts that he could from this village. There were still some Potawatomi there, so he could do a little research. They also gave him some things. He started this building by just building this outer part right here and displaying his collection. The collection grew and so did the building. So at the time that I was there, and he's long gone, the building was probably from the front of this room back to where about where the circulation desk was. He just kept adding on. When you walk in, there's two long display tables. There's just an aisle in between. And it has the best collection that I've seen, certainly in the Great Lake Basin, of Native American artifacts. Just incredible. And he found out all little handwritten notes. Wisconsin so treasures this museum that they hire a docent to staff it so that it can be open for people. So if you're in the Washington area, don't miss this museum. There's also a fishing museum. Many of the people on the island came from a fishing family or there's still fishing that's going on. Two very large fishing sheds comprise a museum. The best part is the docents are all volunteers who are, for the most part, old fishermen or fisherwomen in one case, or who grew up in fishing families. And they come and just tell stories and explain the video, the photographs, and the boats that are there. There was a farm museum, four outdoor farm, anything you can imagine related to farm, including that Washington Island potato sack. And finally, there's a museum on the island that's unlike anything that I saw anywhere else. It's the Washington Island Art and Nature Center, and it's sort of half and half. Half of it is an art gallery that have paintings only done by Washington artists. I think they let summer people also contribute, that are for sale as well, but it's a gorgeous gallery. The other half of it was started by a teacher who set up to do some natural interpretation of what you see on the island. And I noticed that there were more adults probably being fascinated by looking at it. So he's got a beehive in there behind plexiglass. But this has all been done, in a very limited basis, and it's one of the best interpretive museums that I've seen in terms of nature museums. Why I picked this picture, what is this up here? Oh, everybody knows, it's a gnome. And gnomes are like little people in Ireland. They're not just like, you know, we put garden gnomes out perhaps here, but the gnomes really have a different story, historic story in the island. And I made the mistake of calling up to get some more information about something else, and there'd been one of these gnomes on a sod-covered building, and I wanted to know what that building had been because it was closed when I was there. So I was talking to a woman who was going to help me find out, I thought, and she said, well, which building do you mean? There's several that have sod on them. I said, well, you know, the one with the elf on it. And there was this silence, and I thought, uh-oh, maybe that isn't an elf. I said, you know, the dwarf. And she said, that's a gnome. So I guess people here would recognize that, but I just, you know, didn't. And they show up. This is the most public one. The rest of them sort of just show up in odd little places. So that's sort of fun. There's also a lot of interesting cultural attractions there now. This is the historic dairy. It also has an art gallery in it. It has a lavender shop. More things made with lavender than I have ever seen before, edible and non-edible things. This is why I could live on Washington Island the rest of my life. There are three buildings here. You're looking at a bakery that bakes fresh bread every day, and you can smell it down the street. This is Red Cup Coffee Shop. So most Great Lake Basin Islands, other than Mackinac, don't have coffee shops per se. You can get a cup of coffee at a diner or sometimes even someone's house, but not an actual place where they roast and grind and serve great coffee. But probably, and this is my friend Karen sitting out there, I said at one point, I think we're spending too much time here. She said, you're doing research, right? Research. So what helped me a little bit do research is a really good island bookstore over here. And other than Mackinac Island, again, bookstores are relatively rare on Great Lake Basin Islands. Sometimes books are sold in other kinds of stores, but this is a bookstore proper. Some people know Washington Island because they're fabric artists. So there is the Seavers School of Fabric Art there, and they have workshops for one day, 2 days, a week, 2 weeks. And then I'm in the gift shop. I just like the colors of the yarn. But there is a huge barn that is given over to workshops for people interested in fabric art. And people that are internationally known come there to teach. And finally, there is Fiddler's Green, which is probably one of the best restaurants that I went to. As a gourmet chef who got tired of the mainland, so that's good for the islanders, right? Local music every night from a small stage. And they have probably seen in some bars here in the States on the mainland, you can go someplace and play Trivial Pursuit. And, you know, it's like games. They have all sorts of board games. Here they take this very seriously. So every night there's a game going on, music being played, fine food being served. What's not to like? This is a figurehead that's larger than life size that's on top of the restaurant. It's hard to miss. But if there's only one place that you're going to visit on Washington Island, you may want to visit Nelson's Hall. Tom Nelson also came from Denmark, and he is a legend. And the reason he's a legend is no one, not one islander on Washington Island, suffered during the Prohibition. Because Tom Nelson was importing Augustura bitters, which have a high alcohol content, for medicinal purposes. There were a lot of sick people in Washington during the Prohibition. And a lot of Angostura bitters, which is used in, somebody just told me in my last talk, it's a Manhattan, I think, that you put bitters in. So when a drink calls for bitters, this is what you put in. Now, to join the Bitters Club, you have to drink a very generous shot of the stuff. It's very strong, it's very herby and earthy, and you better have something next to your other hand to grab to follow it up with. So once you drink it, then you get a little card that says you're part of the Bitters Club. You sign a book, like a guest book, that goes back. They have a whole library of these books because people have been doing this since Tom opened it up. The building itself is interesting. It did start as a tavern, but it is also the first voting place on the island. It was a dentist office. It was a photography studio. It was where vaudeville and medicine shows were held. So it's got quite the history. On the Bitters card, it says that once you're a member of the Bitters Club, you can do anything an Islander can do. You are accepted as an Islander, which is not the case on most Great Lake Basin islands. On most Great Lake Basin islands, say on my island, Pelee Island, say that I gave birth to my daughter there and she never left in her lifetime, and she's a 90-year-old grandmother, she still would not be an Islander. She would be a cottager. And I see Jan shaking her head in agreement, because on Beaver Island, it's the same way, which doesn't mean that people aren't friendly. It just means Islanders are the people who first came, the first European settlers, and their descendants. On Pelee Island, there are 7 such families. On other islands, there's even fewer. Here we are going over to Rock Island. This is the Carfi, which means ferry. And it's just a quick mile over to this island, and this is where you land on the boat. This was built by Chester Thordarson, who was an inventor. He's from Iceland. This is the replica of the town hall in his city that he had built for him. Down below, it's a boathouse. Up above, it's called the Great Viking Hall. There are other buildings on his estate. This is a caretaker's house. There's about 7 buildings, including a Japanese pagoda. They're all built with limestone from the area. If you go inside of the Great Viking Hall, you see the most amazing collection of wood carving that I've ever seen, at least. He had the woodcarver from Iceland, if you were a woodcarver, you would be able to just blurt out the name, because he's a famous woodcarver. He came over and lived on the island for 20 or 21 years and carved all this amazing furniture and also mantles and that kind of thing for Chester Thordarson. So he designed for every one of these chairs a pictorial depiction of one of the Norse myths, and then he carved it. And they're pretty massive chairs. And the hearth is, you can walk into the fireplace standing up. Beautiful, beautiful carving. This is a quirky thing that's left. This was his too. Chester Thordarson, besides inventions, he died with 300 patents all in the area of electricity and won the 1893 World Fair Medal for one of his inventions. He also had hobbies. He liked game hunting. That is deer hunting, and he liked exotic plants and gardening. Deer, plants. You probably get those things don't mix. So what he did was he built, this is a 912-acre island, he built a fence across the entire thing high enough so the deer couldn't jump over, and what you're seeing is just a gate, the gate that was in it. It's all that's left. That bench underneath there, When I came up the hill, they'd had a group of volunteers from a high school or college, and there were probably 15 or 18 kids sitting on it. This thing is mammoth. And when I called to ask a question about Rock Island, this is a state, Wisconsin State Park, the whole island now. I asked for the ranger that I had met when I was there, and I said, "Hey, Tom, I've got a question." He said, well, I have to back up. When I went to get his number online, I noticed there was a big protest going on because the Park Service was going to take this gate down. And people were really upset. It was a liability issue. I mean, if people try to climb on that, it's like driftwood. So when he answered the phone, I explained to him, I said, "This is Maureen Dunphy," and we talked and blah, blah. And he says, he just interrupted me. He said, "Don't worry, we just worked it out this week. We're not taking the gate down." He thought I was calling to complain. I said, "No, I didn't really know until I looked up your number. It's still there. I think they were going to fence it in." This was in 2014. So I imagine if you went there now, it would be fenced in, but it still is there. At the far end of Rock Island is the Pottawatomie Lighthouse. It's the first operating lighthouse in Wisconsin on Lake Michigan. You can take this 2-track trail around the entire perimeter of the island, which also goes through former Pottawatomie fishing village. And there are hiking signs because this, like I said, this is a state park. This shot is interesting to me because I saw the same shot online after I'd taken this, taken in the winter. So the ice bridge here is no problem from the mainland over. It's 1 mile. People come over to cross-country ski in the wintertime, and I've seen the same picture where people in the summertime go to swim. There's wonderful swimming, there's kayaking, great camping on this island right at the base of sand dunes. But in the wintertime, that's where the folks come up from Washington Island with their cross-country skis, and all those cedars are laden with snow. Very beautiful. We're going to run on to Lake Huron, and we're going to go to the largest freshwater island in the world, which is Manitoulin Island. Has anybody been to Manitoulin? Ah, nice. So Manitoulin Island is a very distinctive island. First of all, by how you get there. Until 1946, you could only get there by railroad or private boat. But since then, there is now a lovely ferry that will take you from the south shore. So you would go up to the Bruce Peninsula, and you would ferry across this small passage. This is how you used to get there. This is a swing bridge. It was built in 1912. And the cool thing about this swing bridge is you see this white truck over here. So this was built only for trains to come across at the north end of the island. But now it is still used as a swing bridge and is open on the hour, every hour, to allow water traffic to get through. So we made sure to leave the island. I was there with Jeannie, my walking partner, and we made sure to leave it right on the hour so that we could see this, the whole mechanics of this. While it was being built, before it was, the motor was installed, 8 men turned that capstan at the bottom, which is pretty incredible. When you cross over, you do not end up on the Ontario mainland right away. You actually end up on Goat Island, which goes to Great Lacloche Island, which goes to Birch Island, and then you're on the mainland. So it's sort of a series of bridges between islands to get where you're going. The thing that's so unique about Manitoulin Island is that 40% of it belongs to First Nation peoples. There are 6 First Nations on Manitoulin Island. So you see a lot of signage. You see a lot of Native people. There are a lot of special events that happen here. In what we know as West Bay, or Meechiging, the Ojibwe Cultural Foundation, relatively new. Like many things on my trip, I just happened to be there for the annual storytelling event. So a woman in her 80s started back with her family history and went through everything that had happened to her tribe, including she was placed in an Indian boarding school, or as we know, residential school in Canada. And the whole story of coming back, and they have a very active language program there now. The people who are there all belong, all of the 6 nations belong to what we know as the Algonquin people or Anishinaabe. So they speak similar language and can understand one another, and they work together. We also know them as the Council of 3 Fires. So Ojibwe is also known as Chippewa by the English settlers. Odawa is known as Ottawa. And then Potawatomi is Potawatomi either way. There's a lot of interesting mixes between the cultures here. This is St. Gabriel Lalemant Church. It's a Roman Catholic church that was built where a Jesuit mission had been. So Jesuits were the first explorers in the Great Lake Basin, and churches were started here. What's a little bit interesting about this church, and I was here on a Sunday, is that you can see that there are Native braves up here on the altar. It's a very different church surface. It was definitely a melding of Catholicism and some of the Native spirit. This is Kagawang. Kagawan means mist rising from falling water, and you can see that's what's happening here. You can see what the height of that waterfall is by the other people there. What you may not be able to see is there are some dark shapes swimming here. This was in September, and the salmon were running upstream. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened to them when they discovered they could no longer go further. Further downstream, the river was roiling with fish to the degree that it felt like you could walk on their backs. I mean, it was packed with huge salmon. We're going to move on to Lake Erie. We're going to go to Kelly's Island. So I want you to look at this picture. What do you see? You see probably a lot of tree cover here. One of the questions that often comes up is, were there pirates on the Great Lakes? And what use did they make of the islands? And people are thinking of pirates on boats, right? There were pirates actually on boats in the Great Lakes. And that's... But for me, Some of the piracy happened on the island. Kelly's Island was bought up lot by lot from, it used to be Cunningham's Island, bought up lot by lot by two brothers from Cleveland, Irad and Datus, back in the early 1800s. When they owned the whole island, or probably a little bit before they owned the whole island, they started what I would say is quite a bit of piracy. So they began by removing every tree just about on the island. And they shipped them off. They were mostly cedars, and they became railroad ties until the island was bare. Why you're not seeing it bare now is this island was taken under its wing in 1953 by the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. Right now, 60% of the island are nature preserves, and the trees have been given a chance to come back. But this is not all that the brothers did. When the trees were gone, and they really were gone, they quarried the limestone out. And they seriously quarried that limestone out. And then they set about to fish the whitefish out, and the whitefish in the bays became very difficult to find. The only good that they contributed to the future was when everything was gone and there was not much shade on the island, they planted vineyards. And even today, there are Lake Erie grapes growing there that wine is made from. If there is anything, though, that is a unifying theme about Kelly's Island would be rock. So Kelly's Island is not part of the Niagara Escarpment. This is a limestone island. All of the islands in the western basin of Lake Erie are limestone islands. This is one of the islands, or one of the quarries that was quarried out by the Kelly brothers. And this little strip right here was ultimately how the limestone was taken to the shore to be shipped off. So there was a little railroad that came on this little thin strip, now known as Horseshoe Pond, because it has a horseshoe curve of water around here. It is a preserve, and there's some wonderful hiking here. Another bit of rock, the glacial grooves. Have you seen glacial grooves? There are glacial grooves in other places. So the short story of glacial grooves is the ice, the tons of glacier ice carving out these lake basins had stuff trapped under it. And by stuff, most of it were large boulders. And they dragged those large boulders. And when they got to the part of the Great Lake Basin that was covered by limestone, it left marks. So you can see this glacial groove, and it is a memorial, is 400 feet long, 35 feet across, and 10 feet deep. It is the best example of glacial grooves because it is the most exposed on the planet. This is how it looks up close. We'd had a little bit of rain, so you can sort of see it looks like a sculptor has used some tools in roughing in some sort of sculpture here. And then you can see how deep this goes. So people ask, well, what was there at the end there? Why are we seeing this? It was quarried. Someone stopped the quarriers. So they thought they had run into a particularly good vein of limestone, and they quarried it out. So right where that stopped is where the quarry operation ended. And because they've been exposed, obviously there's been, when they discovered this and decided to preserve it, this particular strip, it involved digging to get to what had been buried by land over time. Moving forward from the glacial period to the native period, this is a 30-foot limestone, and there's no way to get a good picture of this, but what you're seeing that's covered now with this nice roof a little too late is a 35-foot piece of limestone that the Kelly brothers dug out of the shore and put out in the lake. And the reason they did this was it was covered with pictographs. It's known as inscription rock. They believed that the pictures were drawn by the Erie Nation. The Erie Nation was destroyed by the Iroquois, so there's nobody who really can address that particular issue. It, too, is a state memorial. This was in 1833 that this was dug out. And guess what people did? As cameras became and photography became more possible, they stood and had their pictures taken on this rock. Limestone's very soft, so these carvings became worn down. Fortunately, for what happened later when the camera shots were going on, in 1855, someone came to the island and transferred all the pictographs, and that's what this is. Whoops, sorry. This either doesn't work or it works very fast. They transferred all of the pictographs onto a manuscript, and this is a piece of that reproduced on metal. Okay, sorry, we're having a little speed issue here. I would like to know who exactly visited the Erie Nation, because this doesn't look like a typical pictograph of an antelope or deer. Looks a little bit more otherworldly to me. Moving on to when the European settlers came, rock was all about limestone buildings. This is a German Reformed church. Its value to the island today is that after 100 years of serving as a church, people were leaving and they had decided they would dismantle the church, and it's what caused Kelly's Island Historic Society to be formed to save it. And as a result, they saved a lot of other things along the way. There's a large boat shed right next to the church now that has many, many more artifacts from early Kelly Island days, but you can still go in the church and see there's the original organ is in there. Moving into the contemporary stage, this is Charles Herndon Galleries and Sculpture Garden. He's an Ohio artist that has two galleries on a two-acre piece of property with his home. I didn't meet him. I did see him hanging up laundry from afar. But he has this 2 acres where he's got sculpture just all behind things, in the woods, out of the woods. So my friend Kim and I walked out from a sudden turn, and here was these seven women, like this council. And this was at dusk. So it was rather surprising. We were being followed by a brood of chickens, and I don't really understand what that was about. But he has quite a number of pieces out in the sculpture garden, including this type of more the daubed on, as well as a number of beautiful carvings, all from Great Lake materials, and many showing sort of a native influence. Finally, we are going to go to Lake Ontario. Lake Ontario, of course, is connected to Lake Erie by the Niagara River. So the Niagara Falls has happened. We're much lower now. And we're going to go to the Toronto Islands. Has anybody here been to the Toronto Islands? Yeah, I see a nod. Okay, next time you go to Toronto, or hey, just go to Toronto for the islands. Don't miss them. It's a very, very easy trip. You can imagine, I think, how this was a peninsula once. A large storm blew in and busted up this peninsula into 14 islands and a 15th, which I'll show you in a minute. You can take from just the quay in Toronto free parking. This was a very easy trip. Drive to Toronto, park your car for free, and then go to the ferry dock, which I'll show you in a minute, and you can take one of three ferries across, three ferry routes. There are two areas on the island that still have homes. Quite an interesting story of people trying to stay where they were living after the Toronto Park and Forestry took ownership of the island. 400 people managed to stay there. Their homes are there, and they're all very quirky homes. They're very unusual. So here's the Jack Layton Ferry Terminal, named after a beloved politician from the islands. This is the only time you see people. I started wondering if I was making a mistake. This was crowded. Once you get your ticket and get on a boat, which looks like this, and go the 7-minute trip to the island, you never see that amount of people again. I'm not quite sure what kind of system they have and need to improve. But so at the peak of the season, right now, if you went to the Jack Layton Ferry Terminal to take a ferry across, they are able to transport 4,000 people an hour. But you never see that many people. So I don't know if that's just we could do it, but we don't do it, or I don't know what. But you don't have the feeling when you're on the island. No cars on the island. It's all walking. If you happen to be at the Jack Layton Ferry Terminal in 2012, an 80-foot mosaic was done by one professional mosaic artist and 19 underprivileged kids. And it is gorgeous. It's called Shore Stories. And it's every one of the little individual scenes represents something about the shore or the islands. When you get off of the boat, off of the ferry, whichever one you take, this is the map you see. This is the map you can get. This is a map that you will see in my book. I was able to press that I could put in 24 island maps, the actual maps that I used, if I got permission. So this is one of the maps that is in the book. And as you can see, all of this, these are all activities and things to do. So no cars, bridges between all but a couple of the islands, and all amusement and relaxation opportunities. In between the islands, you see this. There's a lot of water. They're all canals. You see a lot of houseboats. You see a lot of private boats. And what you see on the land are these type of bridges. So there's some pretty massive, interesting arching bridges. This is what I'm with my friend Judy, and we're walking to our underground bed and breakfast. If you want to stay on the island in a bed and breakfast, you have to get it far ahead in advance. There were only four at the time. Many people stay in Toronto, which is much more expensive, and then come over for the day. But I wanted to be there when all the ferry boats stopped running at midnight, and it was well worth doing a little digging to find some place I could stay. All shady, leafy island paths like this throughout all of the islands. In terms of things to do, they have a 1960 type amusement park aimed more probably at grade school children. They have Far Enough Farm, which is all animals except for this windmill that is also a Ferris wheel. They have an amazing carousel. You can ride interesting animals on it. But most of the island is what you see in the upper right-hand corner. A lot of parks, a lot of fountains, a lot of places just to sit and relax. And this is huge, these islands. They also have a lot of what are known in Ontario as blue flag beaches, which mean they're environmentally kept up, both in the way they're maintained and also in the result, what kind of swimming they allow. There is a clothing optional beach. I did not visit it. I just saw the gate to it at one part of the island for adults. And there's a lot of pastoral elements here. So this is St. Andrew Church by the lake. If you're on an island, go to a Sunday church service if you're so inclined, because we got invited home for dinner afterwards. And it was a lovely adventure. It's the way that you find out about the island is to talk to the islanders. And Pete, one of the questions I often get is, well, how did you organize your research? I had a Canon PowerShot, even though I have a good camera, I took a Canon PowerShot camera in my pocket. I took tens of thousands of pictures, never expecting that the press would end up putting 115 of those in the book. I wasn't doing it for that reason. If I went to 136 islands in 27 trips, that meant I was doing multiple islands on each trip, right, for the most part. Isle Royal, well, even there I did three islands. So I needed photo documentation so that when I got back, I could truly figure out what I'd seen and where I'd seen it. The other thing I did was I wrote copiously in a travel journal. So I had a stenographer's pad for every island I visited, and I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. When I was on the ferry, when I was riding my bike, I would stop over on the side of the road, jot some things down. Each of the island chapter begins and ends with part of my travel journal. And then what's in between is the things that you can do. You'll notice in the middle, there is a boardwalk on the Lake Ontario side that is spectacular. It's over a mile long. I was taking my morning walk at 6:30 in the morning, and I had this feeling like somebody was behind me, and I turned around, and this is what I saw. So the tall ships in 2013 and 2014 were on the Great Lakes celebrating the War of 1812, right, the end of it. And this tall ship had no visible person on it, nor was it running under any motor I could detect. It was like a ghost ship, and it was it's still quite an eerie memory. What is this over here in the bottom right-hand corner?
Lighthouse.
It's a lighthouse. Guess what? From that lighthouse, you can see water in no direction. These are young islands. They were busted apart. It was a sand peninsula. It moves a little bit. It moved enough that this island that was built in the 1800s, I think 1840 or 1850, now has no water around it. It did serve as a true lighthouse. So now it's used for wedding, mostly for wedding pictures. People come and pose in front of it. But you can't see. I imagine if you were up on top, it is closed, you would be able to see the lake. But you certainly, you don't even feel like you're anywhere near the lake when you're standing at the bottom of it. In terms of cultural attractions, if they involve food, this is a good place to go. You get off the boat, Island Cafe, people sit and while away summertime. Like, doesn't happen in a lot of mainland places. This is the 15th island I mentioned. This is in the duck pond of the amusement park. And when I kept trying to ask people what the name of it was, they looked at me like I was crazy. The only thing on the island is this very cool hexagon restaurant. And finally, people come from Toronto, the city, to come over just to have dinner here at the Rectory Cafe. Fine dining, and you're sitting right next to, I'm actually standing by that boardwalk that you saw, and the lake is behind me. And over to the right, there's about seating for 60 people. So there is a story about this particular picture. In the 1990s, a Japanese photographer came determined to get the best view of the Toronto skyline he could find. He found it on Algonquin Island, which is the island where our bed and breakfast was, where we were staying. One of the two residential islands, Ward Island, Algonquin Island. He went and stood here, took this picture, published it in a photography magazine where it won wide acclaim. And to this day, the islanders grumble and grumble about the fact that people come to the island, photographers, to stand in this spot and take that picture, which of course I myself did. But there's something else about this picture that I think is instructive, and that is that islands are great places to get a different perspective on the mainland, right? You're surrounded by water. You may be off the grid in terms of cell phone reception part of the time. But it's also a great place to get a different perspective on yourself, in part because of those same things. You're surrounded by water. You may not be able to use your electronic screens. And it's sort of nice to consider that as a very special vacation, a very special retreat. And I'd like to read now from just the end of the epilogue of my book, which is entitled Faring to Island Time. You are on your way, and the island awaits you. Regardless of what you will undoubtedly have forgotten to bring, you may have remembered to bring a camera, a notebook, a pen. But then you forget about the camera, the notebook, the pen, and simply watch the sunset over the water. You are here, now, on island time. It is windy or rainy, cold or hot. The ferry is rolling on dark waves, or heat shimmers above the glass of the lake's surface. Your bones adjust, because adjusting is the only choice you are given. You packed your intentions and arrived clad in your control, and then you gave it all up when you bought your ferry ticket. You give over to island time. You have to cross the water. You need to pay more attention to the weather, and your choices are at once both more limited and more rich, like tea steeped one cup at a time. Once there, you may find you have fewer choices in food, clothing, plans, a welcome paring down. And with this comes the possibility for adventure in every meeting, at each intersection, with any shift in the weather. The basics of food and sleep take on more significance. Sleeping in a breeze, even when the mainland is hitting record three-digit temperatures. Cooking meals on a campfire or a cottage stove. Or going out to a place where the island locals go to eat fresh fish just caught offshore. And to drink wine made from island grapes. On an island, you will often have the opportunity to walk back from your dinner to the place you will sleep that night, and you will take it. You may just find yourself singing aloud as you walk that gravel island road in the evening. Whether you're alone, with traveling companions, or accompanied by new island friends, as the engines cycle down and the ferry heads into the harbor, you find yourself anticipating the island you will now explore, note by note, while composing your own tune in island time. Thank you.